From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Terry Gross is on vacation. Imagine trying to stabilize a province in Iraq shortly after the U.S. invasion, where competing tribal leaders, clerics, and political parties are demanding power and seeking to destroy their enemies. British diplomat Rory Stewart was only 30 years old when the Coalition Provisional Authority sent him to run a turbulent province in southern Iraq. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Rory Stewart about his experiences. He has a new memoir. Also, where are the billions in reconstruction funds for Iraq going? We talk with Ginger Cruz, Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Her office investigates waste, fraud, and abuse. And critic David Edelstein reviews Oliver Stone's new film, World Trade Center. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. By the time he'd reached the age of 30, my guest Rory Stewart had served as a British infantry officer, walked from Turkey to Bangladesh, and been appointed to govern a province of 850,000 people in southern Iraq following the American invasion. He left the country convinced that his early support for the invasion of Iraq was misplaced, and his travels in Asia have left him with reduced expectations of what Western intervention can accomplish. Stewart recounts his experiences in two books recently published. His book, The Places in Between, focuses on his walk through dangerous areas of Afghanistan in January 2002, soon after an American-led coalition drove the Taliban from power. In The Prince of the Marshes, Stewart describes his work as part of the coalition provisional authority governing the Iraqi province of Misun. Well, Rory Stewart, welcome to Fresh Air. You were 30 when you were given the task of trying to bring some order to this province of Iraq, Misun, 850,000 people. It had been very much opposed to Saddam Hussein and had fallen easily when the coalition forces had invaded, but it was beset by tremendous poverty, a lack of any governmental authority, a destroyed economy, and then you have these local leaders that you have to deal with. You mentioned that there was what you described as a fat man in a safari suit, three long clerics in a robe. One was pushing for a gas station franchise. Another wanted treatment for his impotency. How do you figure out in a situation like that who has real authority and who are the imposters, who is sincere and who's working a hustle?
I think it's very difficult even for an Iraqi to work that out. A lot of these people we were dealing with had recently crossed the border from Iran, where they'd been for two decades, often as paid agents of the Iranian government. These were people who had had very colorful lives. Many of them had been imprisoned and tortured by Saddam. Many had had relatives, close relatives, killed by Saddam, had fought from the marshes. Some of them were clerics, some of them were tribal leaders. Their allegiances were uncertain. Political parties had been illegal under Saddam, and suddenly 54 new political parties had emerged in this province. But the advantage that an Iraqi would have over somebody like me is that at least he would have seen these people's families. He would have seen in the small town, Amara, these people at funerals and weddings and in tribal meeting halls, and have a sense of the context in which they operated. They would know perhaps which ones were corrupt and where they were taking bribes from, who it was that was still meeting with Iranian intelligence officers. I, as a newcomer, knew almost none of this.
You know, you were, of course, a part of the Coalition Provisional Authority, and its view of establishing a new government in Iraq was to rely upon moderates within Iraqi society, hopefully educated middle-class people who understood the value of a pluralistic democracy and who could be the bridge to a different kind of future. That doesn't describe most of the leaders that you encountered in the province, but there were some, and I'm wondering how you dealt with those, the kind of the moderates who the Coalition Provisional Authority thought ought to be elevated and in effect put forward as examples of a new Iraqi leadership.
Well, one of the most striking examples is a guy who in the book I call Ali, but whose real name was Haider, and he was a 26-year-old who had studied at Baghdad University, which was very unusual. It's a prestigious university, very unusual for somebody from this remote province. And he spoke beautiful English, and he genuinely believed in a program of human rights and justice, was very pleased that Saddam had gone, and thought that this was the great opportunity to rebuild a more just, more democratic country. And I personally was very charmed by him. I liked dealing with him very much. But of course, the strong sense I got was that he was so far divorced from the reality of political power in the province. He had no interest, really, in Islamist politics, no connection with tribal politics. And his entire manner, his method, his language was totally alien to the kind of people who really controlled the place. And indeed, 5 weeks ago, very sadly, he came in his car into Misun and was dragged out of his car and shot on the street, executed by a militia connected to the current elected government. I didn't describe his didn't put his name in the book because I was worried this kind of thing would happen to him, but now indeed it has, and it's a real example of the problem that the coalition faces in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, which is that we're looking for political leaders and we tend to favor people who are Western friendly, democratic, liberal, and who speak our language of human rights. But these people are very rarely popular, representative, effective, or powerful.
At one point, as people were, as the time of elections was approaching and parties were more organized, you actually reached into the coffers of the coalition to actually give some cash to some of the moderate political parties to help their organization, their organizing. And now, of course, in you know, probably Britain or the United States, this would be an appalling violation of the principles of democracy for the government to fund, use taxpayer resources to fund a political party. This was a very different world. Why was it needed, justified here?
My instinct was that in a very unstable, insecure situation in which the extremists were receiving direct funding from the Iranian Secret Service and from the Saudi government and from the Syrian government, and where attacks, insurgent attacks, were happening daily, and where a lot of moderate, relatively educated Iraqis had nobody to turn to, they had nobody to represent them, it was necessary to give basic funding to the more moderate Islamist parties, people who did, at least to some extent, endorse a legal platform and have some sympathy for notions of justice and human rights. These people needed to be given a chance in order to communicate their message.
You know, a lot of people have criticized the coalition for being so unprepared for the post-war environment. There was clearly far too little planning and resources put in to how to govern a country after it had been, if its leadership had been removed. You know, the looting that was allowed to go on unchecked, the lack of forethought resources, the lack of civil administration and civil police. Had better planning been done, do you think this might have worked?
No, I don't believe so. I think people have much too much faith in planning. I think it's a truism that once this kind of war happens, this kind of invasion happens, planning tends to go out of the window, because the one thing you cannot plan for is the reaction of the enemy, or in this case, the Iraqi population. Yes, of course, mistakes were made. We could have done more planning. We could have made different decisions about the Ba'ath Party and the army. But I don't think these mistakes were decisive. In other words, I believe that even had we invested more money in planning, even had we avoided those tactical errors, Iraq would still have been a mess. And that's a difficult thing for people in government or the military to acknowledge. They don't like to acknowledge what I strongly believe, which is that there is a very real limit to our capacities as American or British diplomats or soldiers. We simply do not have the resources, the commitment, or the political culture to run a country where the population doesn't want us to be there. And I think it's a distraction, and a dangerous distraction, to focus too much on the errors made by the administration, because people who do that are almost implying that somehow if we get those things right, we change our tactics a bit, we do a bit better planning, we'll be able to pull this kind of thing off better in the future. And I think the lesson from this is to be much more cautious about invading in the first place, not to think that somehow if you get your tactics better, you can pull it off.
You know, Iraq some decades ago was had a thriving economy, at least as seen in the Arab world, and a large middle class. Clearly things are in desperate straits at the moment. Can you envision a scenario that should give Iraqis some hope of a stable country? Can they get to a brighter future from this point? Can you see it?
Yes, I do believe that they can get to a brighter future. But for that to happen, we, America and Britain, need to stop micromanaging and interfering. Basically, we need to genuinely empower Iraqi politicians rather than just talking about it. The only hope that Iraq has got, the only way of avoiding a civil war, the only way of building a prosperous future, is for a political resolution to happen between the Shia and Sunni politicians. And that will only happen, in essence, when they're forced to make that kind of resolution. Left to their own devices, I genuinely believe that Iraqis are proud of being Iraqi, or at least Arab Iraqis, I'm leaving the Kurds out of the equation at the moment, that Sunni and Shia Arabs are Iraqi first and Sunni and Shia second, and they will be able to find a negotiated compromise, and they will be able to establish a functioning government.
You said that in Iraq, it's time for the Western forces to withdraw and let Iraqi leaders work this out. I wonder if you think 3 years of occupation has done great damage to the prospects for Iraqis settling their own issues.
I suspect it may have done. My instinct is we should have held elections almost immediately, that the original plan of a light footprint was probably the correct one. I was very struck when I returned last year to find that in Misan, where the British had been very active and tried quite aggressively to defeat armed insurgencies, disarm militia groups, and try to guide the political process, the province was very unstable, whereas in the Italian province next door in Dikar, where I'd served for 5 months, where the Italians, not always for the best of reasons, had done very little. They'd very rarely left their bases. They'd done relatively few development projects. They certainly hadn't attempted to confront armed militias or seriously influence the political process. It was ironically more stable that the Italians, often, I think, for quite bad reasons, had failed to interfere, but the results had been relatively good because the local politicians in Dikar had been forced to sort out their own problems, establish their own security, and find their own compromises. I'm sorry to say that I think that kind of model would have been better throughout the rest of Iraq, but in order to follow that kind of model, the coalition would have had to accept that the kinds of settlements Iraqis are likely to arrive at are not likely to be the kind of settlements we necessarily anticipated or hoped for.
My guest is Rory Stewart. His new book is The Prince of the Marshes. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Rory Stewart. He's a former British diplomat. His account of his governing a province in southern Iraq is called The Prince of the Marshes. He has also written a book about his trek across Afghanistan called The Places in Between. Well, Rory Stewart, I wanted to talk about your walk across some of the most remote areas of Afghanistan, which you did in January 2002 in the winter. Reading this, I don't understand how you didn't die of both frostbite and or gunfire. I mean, it seemed to be an area in which AK-47s are more common than working toilets. Why did you undertake this dangerous journey?
As a British diplomat, I think we suffer enormously in our attempts to engage with the rest of the world from the fact that we tend to analyze these countries either from our own capitals, or if we're in the country at all, from within heavily defended compounds and air-conditioned armored vehicles. I felt that spending the time, I walked from Turkey to Bangladesh, across Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India, and Nepal, staying in 500 different village houses, exposing myself to the landscape, traveling at that pace of 20 or 25 miles a day, and listening to villagers night after night, was very important in order to understand what I see as the key challenge facing us, which is acknowledging differences in cultural perspective. And the other lesson, of course, I took from it, one of the reasons I was very interested in the walk, is that you find that one village is often extremely different from its neighbor, how difficult it is to generalize. In one Hazara village, ruled by a young Iranian-sponsored cleric, things were quite different to the village 15 miles down the road, governed by an old feudal family that had been sitting there for 300 years. And this affected their views on the constitution, their views on central government, their views on their own economic future and their views on other ethnic groups.
The isolation and poverty of these villages that you visited was, you know, quite striking. You said that a lot of them, that many had heard of America, probably not Britain, that some had some idea of what the had heard of the World Trade Center, but really had very little idea of what it had been or why the coalition forces had been bombing their country.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, in some of these villages, the women in particular had never been more than 3 hours' walk from their village in their lives. Often the market town I would have walked from that morning, 5-6 hours' walk away, would be as distant to these women in their own minds as Paris. There was no electricity between Herat and Kabul, and therefore no television. And therefore people perceived the world, related to the world, largely, I found, through the medium of Islam. That was their great global possession. That was what gave them a sense of belonging to a much broader community than simply that of their own ethnic group or their own country. And it was very easy for them to rely on quite a conservative reading of Islam and quite a conservative nationalism.
You know, a lot of us in the West, at least in contrast to the mess in Iraq, see Afghanistan as a relatively successful incursion, you know, having achieved a goal and installed a government which seems to be stable. But clearly over the last year, there are a lot of very disturbing trends. I mean, an escalating pattern of violence and complaints about, you know, warlords increasing and opiates being grown more. What do you see happening in Afghanistan? What's the future there?
I think we need to be careful not to be overambitious for a country like Afghanistan. I think Afghans are relatively happy that there's no civil war now in Kabul, that the extreme brutality of the Taliban government has been removed, from, particularly from areas like Hazarajat, where the Shia Hazaras suffered very badly. Yes, it's absolutely true that Afghanistan is still a very vulnerable, fragile state. There's very strong warlordism. There's a lot of drugs being grown. Government remains weak and often corrupt. However, in some sense, these are the hazards that affect almost all developing countries, countries in sub-Saharan Africa and the neighbors of Afghanistan, such as Pakistan and Tajikistan. They're not problems that can be easily solved by foreigners throwing their weight around and intervening. And I think we should relax a little bit and trust the Afghans to sort things out and not feel panicked, as we often do, into thinking we need to throw, as the United States or Britain, that we need to throw more resources into this situation or that we're in any position to sort these kind of things out.
But, you know, I have to say, I mean, reading the kind of poverty that you encountered on your walk through Afghanistan, and if I read recently, 6% of Afghans have electricity, 20% have clean water. Apart from putting soldiers on the ground, it does seem like there's a need for enormous efforts to provide, you know, sanitation and electricity to some of these rural areas. No?
That's true. The costs of these things are unbelievable. I mean, Afghanistan currently generates less than 100 megawatts of power, and demand is estimated at about 4,500 megawatts. In Kabul, which is a city of 3.5 million people, there is no sewerage system. There's no sewage at all. To install these things and sort it out, I mean, simply to generate that amount of electricity would probably cost $5 or $6 billion before you think about the transmission and distribution lines. To install a complete sewerage system for a city of 3.5 million people would cost into the tens of billions or more. So I suppose the question facing the West is, do we think that the poverty in Afghanistan necessitates this kind of intervention, and do we think the security situation in Afghanistan is going to be sufficiently benign for us to put that number of engineers on the ground to try to sort out those kind of problems? So, yes, of course. I mean, as somebody who now lives in Kabul, and I'm running a project in Kabul which is working on delivering basic services to the historic city and trying to regenerate the historic city, I'm very much in favour of more investment coming in. But we need to be also realistic about what's likely to happen. I was very aware when I was in Iraq and everyone said, why haven't they got the electricity going in Baghdad? That we still have not sorted out the electricity in Pristina, in Kosovo. And that's 7 years after the intervention in Kosovo. We still haven't got the electricity going. We, as the international community, are not very good at these kind of projects. We simply don't implement them very well, even in quite a small, friendly environment like Kosovo with a population of a couple of million. So I'm very skeptical about our ability really to deliver large-scale infrastructural change to Afghanistan, and I wouldn't like to raise Afghans' expectations that we would be able to deliver that.
Well, Rory Stewart, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rory Stewart. His book, The Places in Between, describes his walk through Afghanistan in 2002. He's also written The Prince of the Marshes about his experiences in southern Iraq. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university committed to delivering academic excellence online at capella.edu. From Bob and Mary Montgomery, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Corruption in Iraq is endemic and destructive. That's the finding in a recent report by government auditors. Coming up, we talk with Ginger Cruz, Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. She's just returned from Iraq. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new Oliver Stone film, World Trade Center. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Rebuilding a war-torn Iraq amidst a raging insurgency is a tough job. Accounting for the money spent and assessing the results of that effort are the job of my guest, Ginger Cruz. She's the Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Her office recently released its 10th quarterly report on the reconstruction effort. It cited progress in some areas, but also detailed a series of failures. A $200 million radio network that doesn't work. A hospital whose cost has doubled, and an oil pipeline that dumps crude onto the ground. Ginger Cruz just returned from a 2-month trip to Iraq. Well, Ginger Cruz, welcome to Fresh Air. This is your 10th quarterly report on Iraq reconstruction, and it says in part that most projects visited this quarter showed high-quality workmanship and effective quality control and quality assurance programs. Should we be optimistic about the progress of reconstruction of Iraq?
The progress on reconstruction, Dave, is really a mixed story. While many of our inspections of actual sites, hospitals, railway stations, roads, power plants, showed that in individual cases, the quality of construction was good and the quality control was there, there are significant problems found in our audits and in our investigations with cost issues and with scheduling issues. In addition to that, there are many projects which are yet to start or which are experiencing significant delays because of the security situation. So the reconstruction story is definitely mixed. There are successes that are often not that well known by the American public, but by the same token, there's also a lot of failures, which our reports do find.
Well, let's look at some of the projects that were problematic. One of them was the Basra Children's Hospital. What happened there?
The Basra Children's Hospital was supposed to be completed in December of 2005, and we initiated an audit at the request of the ambassador because there was significant concern that there was not accurate reporting. When we concluded our review, it turns out that the project is going to be about 150% over budget, and it will probably not be complete until July of 2007. Again, schedule and cost delays that are really hindering progress in the health sector. And so right now there is movement by the Gulf Regional Division of the Army Corps to take over the project from Bechtel, which has failed in its ability to get this hospital up and running.
What's Bechtel's explanation for what happened?
Bechtel says that security was a significant factor. They say they've tried to get the project on track but have failed to do so. But that is something that has been experienced all across the country. There are projects that are being executed in governorates all across Iraq that are experiencing security issues. And in many cases, the Iraq contractors who are subcontracted to the larger companies are getting the work done. So when we did our audit, we considered that it was a failure on the part of Bechtel.
Another project that was troubled was an effort to build a new prison at Nasiriya. What happened there?
The prison in Nasiriya started out as a proposal for 4,400 beds, and the contractor on that, Parsons, put in a bid that was way above the amount of money that was available. So there was a negotiation process. At the end of the day, they came to an agreement to build an 800-bed facility, which was significantly diminished from the initial proposal. And they were supposed to complete that by the middle of this year. Instead, again, it's a question of lack of funds and overruns of time. When we went out to inspect the facility, although the quality of construction was good, at the time we were there in early summer, it was only 23% complete. So the Gulf Regional Division, again, the Army Corps, has taken a look at it, decided since the money was exhausted and since the project was not anywhere near completion, they were going to terminate Parsons and instead give the contract directly to the Iraqi subcontractors because there's a greater likelihood that they'll be able to finish the project within the time allotted and within the budget that's left.
You know, it's interesting. I think probably a lot of Americans would assume that Iraqi contractors would be among those most willing to pilfer funds and provide shoddy workmanship, and they would probably believe that Western contractors would be both higher quality and more reliable. It sounds like you're saying that the Iraqi contractors, in some respects, were more reliable.
There is certainly a lot of pressure on Iraqi contractors to do work well because they live and work in that environment. And if an Iraqi contractor is building a facility, they tend to know the people in the village. And if they do shoddy work, the people in the village will know who's responsible for it, and that won't be acceptable. When I was there, I just returned from 2 months in Iraq, went to visit a cardiac facility that was being constructed by an Iraqi contractor. And the cost was remarkably low. It was $500,000 for a facility that had 30 beds in it. It was a critical care unit. And I spoke with the director of the hospital who said that the engineer who was doing the work was someone who'd been a patient at the hospital. He'd had heart problems and he'd been treated there. And so there was a community tie of this contractor to the facility, and he did good work. And as we toured it, we found that the quality of the workmanship was very high. On the other side, I also went to visit some hospitals that were being put up by a large design-build company. I believe it was a Parsons project. And the quality of work was not as good. And part of the reason was it was subcontracted several times. There was not as much management at the site. The international companies, because of the exorbitant cost of security, were not able to put managers and quality control folks on the ground. And so the general quality of construction that we observed when we were there was not as high.
In a corner of this report, it mentions that over this 3-month period that this report covers, there were 56 new contractor death claims. Right?
Yes.
That's 56 people who died simply trying to rebuild Iraq.
Yes. It's something that I think many people don't often talk about or think about. This is one of the deadliest reconstruction programs ever carried out in recent history. The fact that there's 575 people that were working just in the reconstruction area. We're not talking about civilian deaths. We're not talking about military deaths. We're talking about people that were going out to participate in the rebuilding of a water treatment plant or a power plant or a school, who were killed because of their participation in the reconstruction program. And that's something that I think many people are not necessarily aware of, which is very sad.
Another project that has been problematic is an oil pipeline in northern Iraq that spans a couple of canals. What's happened there?
The Zigatan and Riyadh pipelines have been a problem from the beginning, and that is emblematic of some of the problems that we have with reconstruction, where you've got the Ministry of Oil, which is trying to use its ability to get these projects going, mixed in with large companies that are brought in by the United States, and the fact that the coordination between all of the parties is not as crisp as it could be. And so as a result, it falls through the cracks. When we went to do an inspection of those pipelines, they were not nearly complete. The reports that are brought back to the reconstruction program vary widely. Some say it's 80% complete, some say it's 10% complete. It was very hard to nail down exactly how far along these pipelines were. And the problem is, these are critical pipelines. This is a set of pipelines near Al-Fatah that carries oil across both to the refineries and for export. And there's the potential for billions of dollars worth of revenue that's needed so critically for Iraq's operation and for Iraq's capital development that's not flowing through these pipelines because through a series of mishaps, they have not been completed.
Are they leaking?
They are leaking. These pipelines, many of them are extremely old. The sanctions and the years of Saddam Hussein's rule basically took the infrastructure from the 1980s and left it in a state of complete disrepair. So by the time 2003 rolled around and the reconstruction managers from the United States started to try and build up the oil system, it was very difficult because corrosion has really taken its toll on many of these pipelines. The amount of money needed to get all of the oil systems, all of the pipelines and all of the gas oil separation plants back online is substantial. And I talked with Minister Shahristani, who said that the goal is really to use Iraq money, to use international investment, and to get the oil economy going again. But it's going to be definitely a couple of years before the infrastructure will be able to carry the amount of oil necessary to really get the economy back on its feet.
My guest is Ginger Crew. She is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Ginger Crew. She is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Let's look at some of the challenges that the reconstruction effort has faced. You write that in this report that corruption is endemic and destructive. How widespread is corruption in the reconstruction effort?
Corruption is, as defined in the Western world, something that really has been a part of life in Iraq for many years. It was the price of doing business. And so as this new democratic regime is taking form in Iraq, the question of how bad corruption is going to be in this new regime is really something that is a new question for the Iraqi people. They, 3 years ago, under Ambassador Bremer, had the creation of the Commission on Public Integrity, the Board of Supreme Audit was recreated, and the Inspector General system was created. And over the last 3 years, those three entities, we call them the pillars of anti-corruption, have really struggled to create for themselves the conditions necessary to be able to fight this war on corruption. But despite all of their best efforts, despite the fact that there's 36,000 cases in front of the inspectors general, and there's 1,400 cases in front of the CPI, and they estimate about $5 billion worth of corruption that they're looking at, there's still a lot more to do. There was a study that was done under the military in June that found that about a third of Iraqis pay some kind of a bribe for basic public services, for gasoline, for housing, for security, for electricity. And there's a lot of reason, there's a lot of incentive at the moment to see if these ministries can't attack the corruption and get it down to a manageable level, because if they don't, it could certainly threaten the state.
Have there been any bribe attempts on your own inspectors?
Well, we're not in that position. We did have one undercover agent recently who did a sting operation, and as a result, we did get a guilty plea from a U.S. contractor who was attempting to give a $30,000 bribe in exchange for a contract for vests and some mapping equipment for the Iraqi police. We did a sting operation in conjunction with the Joint Contracting Command, and as a result of the undercover operation of our officers, we were able to make the arrest and subsequently get the guilty plea.
Was a lot of money converted to cash and delivered to people to spend?
Absolutely. At the beginning, it was a cash economy. When you were in Iraq, the only way to move the money around, to get it out to the subcontractors and to get it on the ground, was to do so in duffel bags. Much of the Development Fund for Iraq money, the Iraqi money, was done in that manner. And a certain portion of American money was used in that manner, especially when it involved Iraqi subcontractors as well. That makes the record keeping a lot more difficult, and it also makes the ability to go back and account for that money more difficult. And that's something that we are currently tackling, and we're working with the Department of Defense to try and go back and make those records whole to really understand where all the money went.
In May, the new Iraqi government took office, and this raises the question of whether the control of these reconstruction funds are now going to move from American hands to Iraqi hands. What kind of transition issues are you facing?
The Iraqi government has a lot of capacity building issues facing it currently. And I think the thing that reconstruction managers didn't fully appreciate when they came in 2003 was how sheltered and how isolated Iraq had been for 20 years. Much of their infrastructure, much of their master planning, much of their capacity to do work was really stuck in the late 1980s. I visited the mayor's office in Baghdad and talked with some of the water and sewer engineers that were there. And there were these women who'd been working there for 20 years who had hand-drawn the sewer plans for the city, and they knew where the new sewer lines needed to go and where the additions could have helped improve the system incrementally. A lot of times their work was really pushed to the side and fancy solutions were brought in. For example, they brought in AutoCAD, which is a computer system which automates the drawing of a sewer system. And they happily brought that in with printers and all of the latest technology, installed it in the office. And I'm looking at these women who had, most of them, never used the internet, never used computers, and all of a sudden they have to go from hand-drawing these sewer maps to using the latest in technology. The gap there is significant. It's going to take more than a 5-week training program from the people who own the computer system to get them up to speed, and I think that's an example of what's going on all across the country.
We just interviewed Rory Stewart, who was in the British Foreign Service, and he was effectively in charge of a province in southern Iraq in the first year following the invasion. And he told us that when he went back a year later to the region that he had worked so hard to help redevelop, that it was striking how many people said that they had done nothing, accomplished nothing. They seemed to have gotten no credit for the efforts they had made. You've been to Iraq. Do you have any sense of how the reconstruction efforts are regarded by Iraqi citizens?
The feedback that we get is mixed, and the disconnect is really a function of output versus outcome, and let me explain that. In many cases, the American investments have produced products which are not necessarily impacting the lives of the Iraqi people. In other words, if we've built water treatment plants, if the Iraqi government itself is not able to fix the water pipes that actually go to people's houses, the person on the street does not see the value because they're not getting better water. We've built a lot of the generation plants, but if the distribution networks are not there and the power lines are not bringing that power to the people, and they still get up in the morning and only have 4 hours of power all day, they are not going to see the value of what has been put forth by the reconstruction program. It's really an uphill struggle. If the Iraqi government is able to get security in hand, once they are able to control the security situation, the ministries will be able to get the facilities back online, and there will be a boomerang, we're hoping. There'll be all of that capacity that's been built up will finally come to bear, and then the Iraqi people will be able to see it. But until the security is there and until the capacity is there, it's going to be some time before we start to get that feedback from the people.
You know, many journalists have gone to Iraq and reported citizens saying they don't understand how the most powerful nation in the world can't keep the lights on. And if they are angry at the United States for its failures to provide their needs, I guess that only feeds the insurgency, which makes the security situation worse and harder to achieve the fruits of the projects that have been built.
That certainly is the case, and it's something that reconstruction managers think of every day when they're out there and they're trying to come up with solutions that will result in actual progress, visible progress that will be seen and enjoyed by the residents that are there, whose lives we've tried to make better, but who for a variety of reasons are not seeing the results of the programs. Part of the reason, again, is, you know, a lot of times the larger, more ambitious projects that we invested in have not yet borne the fruit because that last mile, that power distribution line, it's that water distribution line, it's that last critical mile that needs to occur before people will begin to see the fruits of the investment. And in a lot of cases, we've talked to Iraqi engineers and people on the streets who make that comparison. They say after the first Gulf War, Saddam Hussein and the ministries were able to jerry-rig everything and get the services back. And that's true because they didn't try to improve everything. They just tried to put it together with chewing gum and rubber bands, and they got it running again. In the case of the U.S. reconstruction effort, rather than taking that approach, the approach was taken, since we've got $21 billion, let's modernize the whole system. Let's bring Iraq into the 21st century.
Sounds like you need $10 million for chewing gum and rubber bands.
In some cases, Iraqis say, why didn't we do that? There's a couple of engineers who say that perhaps the correct strategy would have been to bring Iraq back to where it was prior to the war, literally just take the old systems that they had and switch out the boards and use the old equipment and get it just barely running, and then give them the capability to begin on a road towards improvement. But I think that's part of what America tries to do. And in a lot of cases, again, the potential is there. It's just a question of harnessing that potential, getting the security situation to where these resources and these infrastructure pieces can actually start to produce what they were designed to produce. And once they're able to do that, I've no doubt that there will be a huge improvement in the lives of the Iraqis. But until we can get through this patch, until the security situation is fixed, and until the capacity of the ministries is in place, we won't be able to see that.
Well, Ginger Cruz, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Ginger Cruz is Deputy Inspector General for Iraq Reconstruction. Coming up, David Edelstein on the new Oliver Stone film, World Trade Center. This is Fresh Air. Oliver Stone's new film World Trade Center opens tomorrow. Nicolas Cage stars as a Port Authority cop trapped in the rubble. Critic David Edelstein says the film raises a lot of questions about how we grieve.
It's been fascinating to watch Hollywood transform the events of September 11, 2001 into the stuff of commercial thrillers. How gingerly the filmmakers of United 93 and the New World Trade Center went about their work. How exhaustively they interviewed participants and family members of those who died, labored to mitigate the sensationalism of their subject matter, and purged all traces of politics, especially geopolitics, from the stories they set out to recount. And how telling that they reshaped 9/11 around narratives of old-fashioned American courage. Earlier this year, some critics charged that Paul Greengrass's United 93 was essentially a conventional Hollywood rah-rah hero movie in documentary clothing. An odd criticism, given that those heroes weren't conventionally introduced, we never even knew their names, and rather unconventionally perished. Oliver Stone's World Trade Center, although closely based on facts, does resemble the hero-worshipping films of the past. It's beautifully made. Audiences will gasp and weep. I did. But it's also a film with a very Hollywood kind of tunnel vision. The movie is misnamed. The focus isn't the World Trade Center as a whole, but two real-life Port Authority police officers, John McLaughlin and Will Gimeno, played by Nicolas Cage and the superb Michael Peña, one of the stars of last year's Crash. They're part of a team that goes into Tower 1 to rescue trapped inhabitants. In the first floor concourse, McLaughlin improvises. He can't even confirm that the second tower has been hit. And he can't imagine the smaller explosions and groans of steel he hears are harbingers of the collapse to come.
Grab those bottles. Get the helmets. Okay, turn them on. Double check. Test them. Massey.
Hold on.
Anything more here? Helmets, Scott packs?
No, Sarge. Try the E-room near the truck docks in the basement. Jimmy Lynch is dead.
Thanks. Okay, there's more stuff down on B1, the truck docks. We'll drop down to concourse, go around 1 to 2, and there's some stairs there. Keep your eyes open, follow me. Don't get separated, okay?
No, Sarge, we got plenty here.
110 floors, fire with fuel. We're gonna be using up bottles, we need them.
Sarge. You won't believe this. Your Suburban on Church, it's gone. Roof smashed in.
Stay together and stay focused.
Well, Don, where we going?
Sarge wants more stuff.
What?
Don't worry about it. He knows what he's doing.
What the?
Don't think. Keep moving.
Jesus, Sarge, we gotta get up there.
You aren't rescuing anybody if you can't breathe, Rodriguez. Stay focused.
The opening makes you think World Trade Center might be a towering inferno kind of disaster picture, but Stone backs off from spectacle. There's no carnage on display. We don't see the planes hit, only a shadow over the Port Authority. The collapse of both towers is experienced from inside, a massive boom and lethal shower of steel and concrete. For most of the film, we're with McLaughlin and Gimeno as they lie pinned under slabs, waiting for help, talking about their wives and children and anything they can think of to keep from passing out. That's when Stone cuts to their spouses, Maria Bello as Donna McLaughlin and Maggie Gyllenhaal as the very pregnant Allison Gimeno, both nearly going mad as they hold out for word of their husbands. Bello's escalating anger is deeply affecting, and Gyllenhaal uses her natural spaciness to suggest the way a pregnant woman in that situation might be half in and half out of her body. I'm not sure why I found those scenes so out of place. Maybe it's because these two women are so unrepresentative of the tens of thousands of loved ones who feared the worst, and the worst is what there was. This is a hopeful, true story, but viewing September 11th through this prism felt to me like a Hollywood fantasy. A lot of people didn't want the lefty conspiracy-mongering Stone to get his paws on September 11th, but World Trade Center isn't remotely a conspiracy film. As someone tired of his amphetamine-style filmmaking, I appreciated Stone's self-effacement, along with the normally self-consciously weird Nicolas Cage's self-effacement, too. And Stone can be a great director. He views that terrible day with the heightened clarity of grief. The cops and firemen in the early scenes already seem like ghosts. World Trade Center raises two questions. Is reframing September 11th, in terms of individual stories of valor, a necessary stage in our collective healing? Or is it a denial of the deeper and more lasting horror of that day? Or is it both?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice, in stores and online at bn.com. From Rosalind Croman Swig, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the true story of a plot by a band of mercenaries to overthrow a corrupt African dictator and grab the riches he's getting from American oil companies. We talk with Adam Roberts, author of The Wonga Coup. Also, actress Maria Bello, the star of A History of Violence, is in the new film World Trade Center. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.